Our next guest, Ben Killam, has been researching and living with black bears for nearly 20 years. He's become an expert in black bear behavior as well as rehabilitating orphaned and injured bears and reintroducing them into the wild. And he's invited to lecture all over the United States, also internationally. His previous book is Among the Bears, Raising Orphan Cubs in the Wild. Ben and his work with black bears has been featured in 5 internationally televised documentaries, including National Geographic, Discovery Channel. He's appeared on the Today Show, ABC Nightly News, CBC's Nightly News, and various other shows, as well as National Public Radio, and a host of other nationally broadcast radio shows. He's going to be speaking to us from his home in New Hampshire. His new book is called Out on a Limb. And Ben, I want to welcome you to the Roadhouse.
Thanks, Buck. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed your book. I was telling my co-host when I first saw the book about black bears, I thought, oh, man, another book about black bears. But I was so surprised at what I learned reading your book. It was quite an adventure for me. And I do want to mention to folks that you came from a high-achieving family, both in academics and medicine. You have very high IQ, graduated from college with a 4-year degree. But you struggled, as I understand it, a little bit in getting that degree and were denied the opportunity to go to graduate school, all due to what turned out to be dyslexia. Can you talk a little bit to our listening audience about how that has affected your life and in what ways, good and bad, and also in leading to what you're doing now?
Well, when I graduated from college and University of New Hampshire in 1974, and I had hoped to go on to graduate school, but my poor test scores, grade scores, I failed to get into graduate school. As a result, I went to a trade school in Colorado and learned the art of gunsmithing and have employed myself as a custom gunsmith over the last 30 years. And I've worked at a number of places, including Griffin and Howe and Colt Firearms. Before starting my own business in 1982 in New Hampshire. And my wife and I moved back to New Hampshire at that point, my wife Debbie. And I'd hoped to continue the work that I was interested in wildlife. And my interest at that time was in studying carnivores. And I had a leg up on this because my father, Lawrence Killam, who was a virologist at the Dartmouth Medical School, studied birds as an avocation and wrote a book on the woodpeckers of the eastern United States as well as a book on crows and ravens. So I grew up in a household with lots of wild animals around, and I had a lot of experience with them. But studying carnivores is a little more difficult than studying birds. My dad prided himself on a simple apparatus, a pair of binoculars, small folding chair, and my mother would sit in front of woodpecker nests and document courtship and behavior. But carnivores, for anybody who's been in the woods, know they disappear rapidly into the thick brush. It's very hard to view them for very long. And I wasn't thinking about bears when I got started. I was thinking about a coyote or a bobcat or perhaps a fisher, the large woodland weasel we have around here. But it happened to be bears that came my way. And the method that I thought of, based on my childhood experience of raising orphan animals, was to raise an orphan loose in the forest and document its juvenile behavior and use that to understand its adult behavior. And when bears did come my way, they turned out to be the ideal animals to study in that fashion because they're very deliberate in their ways and have a long juvenile.
Now, how did you come about actually having bears in your home? How did you end up with cub bears to raise?
Well, when we started out, my sister Phoebe and I became wildlife rehabilitators to legally access one of the animals that I was interested in. Black bears were not being rehabilitated in New Hampshire or Vermont at the time. But one fall, a conservation officer broke departmental policy and brought us an 11-month-old cub that he thought had been hit by an automobile, and he didn't have the heart to euthanize it. And we had our veterinarian check it out, and it had not been hit by a car, and it had no infectious disease, but it was still wobbly. And it couldn't stay on a branch or a log, and it would swat and carry on. And I was interested in finding out what was wrong with it. It was quickly confiscated from me, lacking a permit. But later that spring, I got a call from the director of Fish and Game in New Hampshire, and he asked me if I'd take the cub back. And we got the cub back and ultimately found out what was wrong with it. And later that spring, I got a call from Vermont Fish and Wildlife, who heard about what I wanted to do. And they had two orphan cubs as a result of their Stratton Mountain bear study. And they asked me if I'd take them. And I said, I'd like to, but there's a little issue of a permit. And I said, if you'll talk to New Hampshire and they'll provide a permit, I'll take the cub. Next morning, I had a permit in hand. And since that time, we've raised, rehabilitated, and returned to the wild over 100 black bear cubs.
That had to be an amazing adventure to have those little cubs in your home and trying to decide, you know, how should I raise these little, what do they want? You know, what are they asking me for? What do I need to do?
Well, the first cubs were definitely an adventure, and I simply had to use my wits and intuition and figure out what they wanted. And fortunately, bear cubs, or unfortunately maybe, but bear cubs tell you what they want. They're like human children. They use pain and pleasure to manipulate their caregivers to make sure they get what they want. And it was up to me to figure out what their needs were. And instead of crying and smiling, they bite and have good behavior. So there was an awful lot of bruising going on.
I understand you learned to wear two pairs of pants when you're handling especially the juveniles.
Yeah, well, especially when they're very young, their claws are razor sharp and they climb. You know, a dog is on two dimensions, but a bear has three dimensions. They go up. And they go up your pant leg and those claws go right through to your skin. It's quite exhilarating.
One thing that really, and I'm sure it surprises most people who read your book, is the idea that's been ingrained with me is that bears are pretty solitary creatures. But you've sure shown in your research that that's far from true. Can you talk a little bit about their social structure?
Yeah, in studying these cubs, these bears for 20 years and having them as cubs and then following them into the wild on using their tracking collars and spending the day with them and then finally having them come to me, I've gotten a good broad sense of what their social behavior and social structure is. And my methods of doing things is basically assembling observations and recognizing that the bear's behavior is a system. And the more observations I assemble, the better understanding I have of the system. And all the parts have to interrelate and work. And what I found was that the closest thing that a bear has to a territory or a defended area is the female home range. And these female home ranges are evenly spaced on the landscape. Yet their food supply, which is the highest quality foods in the forest, the nuts, berries, and ant seeds, and grubs, are unevenly dispersed on the landscape. So at any given time, one female bear may have a huge surplus of food in her home range, and her immediate neighbor can have nothing. And this has led to a system of sharing over time. So they turn out to be reciprocal altruists, which is a type of social behavior, a tit for a tat, if you will, that parallels early human behavior.
Maybe you could talk about the bear Squirty, who was one of the cubs that you raised, who has really let you into her life for, I think she's, 17 now. And a lot of the information that you've gleaned has been hanging out in the woods with your bear Squirty.
Well, Squirty's been a tremendous advantage in that she's lived as long as she has. And because I raised her from a cub, came to me when she was 3 pounds, 7 weeks old, and I raised her, walking her loose in the forest, and she left me to become an adult or sub-adult and find her own home range, and later share that home range, expand it, and share it with daughters and granddaughters. And the important thing about Squirty is that she treats me like a bear. There's no intimidation between myself and her, which can be painful at times because I've learned that Squirty has rules, and she also judges and punishes. So if I break the rules, I get bit, and I have to be very careful around her because of that. All the other bears that I work with, I intimidate. And they are below me in the hierarchy, so I don't have those kind of issues with them. The insights that I've learned from Squirty have been tremendous.
I was amazed that you could be in the woods with Squirty with her young cubs, and she accepts you readily despite the presence of the cubs, and also seems to intervene if another bear comes around who might be a threat to you.
Yes. Squirty, when her cubs are very young, I have to keep my distance because she's more protective of them. But as they get older, she doesn't care so much about them. And she has on a couple of occasions. I was following Squirty one time, and she was with her mate. And this mate was a fairly boisterous male. He was about 400 pounds. And I wanted to document their courtship, and things were going very well for the first 4 days. He was honoring my existence, walking wide arcs around. But on the fifth day, when I went to see Squirty and what she was up to, the male came down within 10 feet of me. I was filming everything. I felt a little bit uncomfortable. And then he came closer. He came to about 4 feet, and Squirty lunged at him and went, "Oh," which means, "Go sit down." And he dutifully went and sat down. And I got uncomfortable and decided it was a good time to leave. And, you know, just using my intuition, I thought they'd be happier without me there. But when I went to leave, he again tried to cut me off. He came right towards me with his eyes locked on me. And again, she lunged into him and went, "Oh," and he dutifully sat down again. And I couldn't believe that he didn't want me to go. And so after a few more minutes, when he relaxed, I decided to try leaving another direction. And again, he came right towards me and cut me off. Again, she lunged at him and went, "Oh," told him to go sit down. And again, he just sat down. Then I was there for the duration. And I filmed them together for 35 minutes before she finally finished the treat that I'd given her. Ran off down the hill and followed it.
Maybe this is a good time to also talk about, oh, by the way, I'm amazed at your belief system that all that was going to work when this 400-pound bear is 4 feet from you. But it might be a good time to talk about the male's role in this social order.
Yeah, male bears are a lot more difficult to study. Initially, I tried to put telemetry collars on them, but they just disappear over a mountain. Their home ranges can be 200 square miles or more, and then you spend all year long chasing them, trying to figure out where they've been without learning very much. And then as the trail cameras got more affordable, I started using trail cameras to monitor the extra bears in my female home ranges. And I found that it was not unusual. I put a small amount of corn in front of one of my monitoring cameras, and it wasn't unusual to film 8 or 10 different bears within a 2-week period when I'd set them up in high activity areas like clear cuts after logging. And things didn't make sense for a long period of time, and that's often how it is. But finally, in 2008, I had the perfect circumstance. It was a clear cut that was about 16 years old and going by in its productivity. And I set up, and I got my 8 or 10 different males. And in 2009, the only bear there was the resident female. The males were gone. But in 2008, I set up my cameras, and I had an awful lot of pictures of two males in front of the camera sharing a small amount of corn. And this indicated friendships or coalitions. And I realized that these males were forming loose groups of strangers to overpower the female to access the surplus food in the female home range. And I knew these were strangers because I'd done the DNA using hair snares and hair samples of all the bears in my study area. And the males were genetically unrelated.
That would kind of give an idea about juvenile males, but I was kind of curious about the larger males. Do they just wander then from a territory to territory? Do they have a home base?
Well, the breeding males, and it's the 350-pound-plus males that do all the breeding, they have breeding territories. And subadults are still around. The subadults will follow and mentor off these 350-pound males. And they'll access the females and breed multiple females, up to as many as, possibly as many as 10 different females in one season. So they're roving over many different female home ranges. But when the time comes that the breeding season is over, the females don't tolerate them any longer, competing with them and their cubs. And the females ask these big males to move along. And they tend to go to areas where there's surplus food, either agricultural fields or landfills or dumpsters or any place there's excess food that these males are going.
One thing that that we hear often and we grow up learning and hearing is that animals act instinctually, you know, that they don't have the capability of remembering things in, that happened before or intentionally doing things to change their environment. Yet a lot of your work has shown just the opposite, that these bears have the capacity to remember, of course, and project in the future and know what the intentions of others might be. And also, the biggest surprise was their ability to cooperate. They're not solitary creatures. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the recursive behavior of remembering the past, applying to the present, and projecting into the future. That footage that I shot with Squirty and the big male, the reason he didn't want me to leave was that on the first day that I met with Squirty and he showed up, when I left, he followed. And when that day that he didn't want me to leave, he had remembered Squirty following. He didn't want to risk her leaving with me because they were mating at that time, and that would give another male an opportunity come in. So he stopped me, and he was projecting her actions into the future. He was thinking that if I left, she would leave. And so he was trying to control the situation. And I was lucky enough to get it all on camera, so it's something other people can review.
I'd like you also to talk about what you discovered an organ in bears that seems to be responsible for a lot of their behavior traits that you've followed, and that is the Killam organ that helps them sense odors to a high degree. And
yeah, the Killam organ is an accessory organ to the vomeronasal system, and typically bears, like dogs, have two olfactory systems, the vomeronasal system, which identifies scent, and then the nasal epithelium, which learns from the vomeronasal system and later on can locate it and identify scent. And typically, the vomeronasal system, the dogs or bears will use their tongue to pick up scent in their saliva, and they're picking up large molecules of scent and offering it to a small bump behind their incisors called the papilla of the vomeronasal organ. And with this accessory system, it allows them to identify aromatic compounds. And I discovered it because there's a sensory. It lays in the vomer, which is a V-shaped bone that lays under the nasal septum, and there's a pocket in the vomer. And there's a sensory nerve that comes down through the bone to the roof of the mouth. And I discovered it because the cubs were mouthing all the leaves of the vegetation they were to eat and just holding them in their mouth and releasing the leaf unharmed. And I wondered what was going on. So I identified all the different plants that the bears were mouthing and what the ultimate result was. And the cubs that in the first summer had identified 125 food items that rejected any more. And so I wondered, you know, how they were doing this. I ultimately got a roadkill bear and did some rather crude dissection. And that's when I discovered the organ. Through, you know, more years of working and looking at this organ, I also discovered there were six sensory nerves that run up the vomer underneath the brain and spread out across the roof of the throat, so that all aromatic compounds that come through the air, through their mouth or nose, go over these sensory nerves that they get a reading on. So the bears, all their long-range communication is done with aromatic. And they have no long-range vocalization. And the animals, the mammals that lack this organ, like coyotes, wolves, chimpanzees, pandas, all have long-range vocalization.
It seems as though that scent plays a part in the way that society is run among bears. As I read your book, by the way, Out on a Limb, published here this year, and that the bears can leave a scent intentionally, but they always leave a scent unintentionally, and that doesn't allow them to get by with much.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because they judge and punish, there's a transparency about wherever they travel, so they can't go anywhere without leaving scent that other bears can detect. So they can follow each other to find food and follow each other to punish. And it would be—it's kind of like if all of us had GPS trackers on us. NSA could keep track of all of us all the time.
Yeah, it doesn't allow you to get by with much. I guess you're going to get punished if you make a transgression.
That's right. They can't. They really don't get away with anything.
Yeah.
So their judicial system is far superior to our own.
Yeah, they got a fail-safe built in there. So, you know, I wanted to hit. We were running out of time, but I just wanted to hit one more thought. And we talked earlier about your dyslexia, which was finally diagnosed when you were 40 years old. But can you tell folks about what you see, how you see in pictures rather than in some larger overarching theories, and how that relates to how successful your study has been and why it's successful with black bears?
Well, seeing in pictures has been a real advantage for me, and the disadvantage to it is that nobody else seems to understand it. But when I was doing my gun work, I could load, when I was designing a firearm, I would load all the mechanisms into my head with pictures, and then I could rotate them. I could see them in 3D, rotate them, manipulate them, work them, and finally I would build a prototype that worked. And when I'm doing my bear work, I'm doing the same thing. I'm loading images into my head, and I can see them all work. When I take my field notes, I would go for long walks with the cubs, maybe 9 hours at a time. I'd come back in the evening and do my field notes, and I'd just turn on my computer, then I'd turn on the video in my head, and I'd go rewalk the walk, pay attention to everything that I saw that day. And I could see it in vivid detail, and it made it very easy to concentrate on what I was seeing and make good observation.
We've been speaking with Ben Killam, and Ben has just written his second book about his work with black bears. It's called Out on a Limb, and I'm sure it's available anywhere that books are sold, Ben. And do you have a website that goes with your books?
Yeah, you can go to benkillum.com and read more about what I do.
Well, I'd like to tell folks out there that I found it to be a fascinating book. I learned a lot about bears, but I also learned a lot about people, and especially as you made it so easy to follow their social structure and compare it to our own. We didn't get to a lot of the topics in your book, but people can catch that by going online and finding one or walking to their neighborhood bookstore. Ben, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time during the holiday season.
Well, thanks, Buck. I really enjoyed being on.
And I hope that you have a great new year, and we'll be looking for more work to come out in the future.